They moved the animal farm into a big factory so you and I could have cheap food. But Michael Olson's third law of the food chain tells us that cheap food isn't. And so today we pause to ask, is there a viable alternative to the factory farm?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
You are tuned in to the 629th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Puerto Montt who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford.
Hello, everyone.
Farmily Stafford is out for the day, folks. Progress always seems to be a matter of containing ever more people on the same amount of land. To date, agriculture has done an incredible good job of keeping up with progress, as we now have billions of people living where millions lived a few short decades ago. Some of agriculture's increased productivity has been made possible by the Green Revolution of Norman Borlaug and Associates, who developed higher-yielding strains of crops like wheat and rice, and more productivity is likely coming as a consequence of our newly won ability to manipulate the genes of plants to make them do what they otherwise would not be able to do. But perhaps the biggest gain in productivity has come from learning how to grow more plants and animals in ever smaller spaces. This ability has changed the nature of animal husbandry. Where there were many chicken farmers raising a couple hundred chickens each, there are now a few chicken farmers raising a couple hundred thousand chickens each. Where there were once many hog farmers growing 100 hogs each, there are now a few hog farmers growing many thousands of hogs each. These factory farms produce an abundant supply of cheap food, which means you and I can enjoy a hamburger or a chicken sandwich for a small amount of pocket change. But wait, whenever we hear someone say cheap food, we run for the door, because cheap food isn't. Rancher Bill Nyman recognized that many consumers do not want factory-farmed meat, and so built a $65 million business on the righteous raising of food animals, Nyman Ranch Meats. And lawyer Nicolette Hahn Nyman waged a war on factory farms on behalf of Robert Kennedy Jr.'s Water Keepers Alliance before becoming a rancher and authoring Righteous Pork Chop, Finding a Life and a Good Food Beyond Factory Farms. Today we pause to ask Bill and Nicolette Nyman, is there an economically viable alternative to the factory farm? Bill, let's start with you, and welcome to the Food Chain. Good to have you aboard.
Hey, Michael, it's an honor to be on your show.
So, a quick background from school teacher to cattle rancher?
Some might think that's a giant leap, but in my circumstances, it wasn't. So I actually began teaching school in the San Joaquin Valley, which, in spite of what the people in the heartland of America think, I think that's the breadbasket of the country today.
Right.
And I was surrounded by farmers and became inspired there as I moved to Marin County.
So from cattle rancher to Nyman Ranch Meats.
Well, what happened, there was a couple of key turning points, the tipping points. I was began in a small community north of San Francisco with other like-minded people trying to feed our families, extended family, and I guess you could...
In the little town of Bolinas, with that has no directions to get to it, right?
Right, like Brigadoon. So we began feeding our family and our neighbors and extended family and community, and there was a division of labor. Some folks were raising vegetable crops and mm-hmm. fruits, and others were raising animals, and where I lived was more suited to growing animals, and learned the trade, learned the vocation one step at a time, and was fortunate to be surrounded by some neighbors who were really good at what they do in terms of animal husbandry and raising their animals in a completely traditional and natural way.
Mm-hmm. And that's how you founded the Nyman Ranch Meats, right? Is that
What happened in 1984, I began, you know, selling to neighbors and community in the early 70s right up to the early 80s. And throughout that period of time, I acquired more and more beef cattle because grass was the crop we were growing here, and I mean the kind of cattle graze on.
Right.
And in 1984, the government, as our herd increased, the government, in its infinite wisdom, decided that there was a surplus of dairy products, and decided to manage the surplus to buy up dairy herds and send those mother cows and dairy cows to slaughter. Well, the end result was that the market was flooded with beef because dairy cattle make up a 35% or more of the beef that's eaten in the United States. And as a result of that, the market being flooded, the value of our calves, which up until that time we were, after weaning, they would get on a truck and go to Wyoming and eventually
right.
probably would end up in Nebraska. So they became valueless in the marketplace, and my partner Orville Schell and I decided that at that time, decided we would, instead of selling cattle, we would sell meat because we had some experience with hogs that we had been raising until that time and selling as meat. So there you go. We launched Nyman Ranch, at that time known as Nyman Schell, and became a company. And little by little, one by one, we added neighboring farms and customers one at a time. And the company grew to the annual revenue, which you mentioned, of $65 million in, 2005.
Right, and from Nyman Ranch Meats back to cattle farmer, right? Cattle rancher.
Right. Now, I'm, of course, the whole reason for getting in the meat business, which is a tough business, and it doesn't attract the all the best people in the world, and so we I'm now back doing what I really was passionate about in the beginning, and that's raising animals and showing that you can treat animals well and raise them to produce wholesome and wonderful food for human consumption.
Good. Let's go to your partner. I guess, Nicolette, today we're working Age Before Beauty.
That works here.
That works there? Okay. Nicolette Hahn Nyman, rancher, lawyer, and author of The Righteous Pork Chop, Finding a Life and Good Food Beyond Factory Farms. Welcome to the food chain, Nicolette.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good to have you. So from lawyer to vegetarian warrior.
Yes, it was kind of a gradual progression. I was hired by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's an environmental attorney, in 2000 to be the senior attorney for his environmental group called Waterkeeper Alliance, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I didn't have any background or knowledge at all about what was happening in the livestock industry. I had grown up in Michigan, and I had spent time on farms. And I had a sort of a bucolic picture in my mind that resembled the farms I'd spent time on as a child.
Isn't it amazing how that image always sticks in your mind?
Yeah.
No matter what the reality is. I mean, when we think of farms, yeah.
You know, in their mind right now of how their food is being produced. And it's kind of where we want our food to come from.
Yeah, exactly.
But unfortunately, it's so different from the reality. And when I started working for Bobby Kennedy, he very quickly, after I started, asked me to launch a national campaign to try to address the pollution from large concentrated livestock operations. And at the time that he asked me to do that, I did not understand why the issue was of such significance, but I began learning very quickly that it was one of the most significant water pollution problems in the United States.
And that's something we hope to get to here in a few minutes. So from vegetarian warrior to cattle rancher.
Yes. Well, that was an unexpected step that would not have happened probably had I not, you know, met and fallen in love with Bill Nyman, your other guest.
Uh-huh.
So that was just a kind of a funny twist to the saga. I had actually, when I met Bill, the reason I met Bill was because I was working for Bobby Kennedy, and I actually was originally asked by Bobby just to sort of launch a series of initiatives, including litigation and efforts to reform regulations and get things enforced more that were already on the books, sort of against the big, bad, polluting livestock operations. And it was my feeling, once I started doing the work, that if we were really going to try to improve the situation with meat production in the United States, our organization should also be holding up good models.
Okay.
And
you found a good model, didn't you?
Yes, a very good model.
Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. Today we're going to have a lot of fun with some very interesting people, Bill and Nicolette Nyman, and you. Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We're asking if there is a viable alternative to factory farms. When will we get back? How did we go from chicken farms to chicken factories, hog farms to hog factories? So on, right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Hey, guess what? One telephone number, two great guests today. Life is good. Bill and Nicolette Nyman. Bill, very famous throughout the world for his founding of Nyman Ranch Meats, one of the premium brands of meats that you could ever find throughout the United States. Oh, my goodness, what yummy food that Bill made, Bill and his farmers. How many farmers did you have working with you at Nyman Ranch, Bill?
Well, it grew to the current size of the network of beef, sheep, and pork farmers, ranches and farmers, about 600, over 600 family-owned farms.
600 family-owned farms. My goodness.
Most of them are west of the Mississippi, but there's some in Illinois and Michigan as well.
Mm-hmm. And boy, did we love eating your meats. Being a Montana boy, I was kind of raised on meats that did not come from the factory farms and from the big feedlots. So it was kind of like going home again for me. Nicolette Han Nyman, author of Righteous Pork Chop, Finding a Life and Good Food Beyond Factory Farms. I'd like to start with you today and talk about how we went from chicken farming to chicken factory farms.
You did
an excellent treatment on that in your new book, and I thought it would be a good place for us to start today.
Yeah, I think and that's what my book does. It starts there because what happened with me was I realized when I started working for Bobby Kennedy as an environmental lawyer and he asked me to work on meat industry pollution that, you know, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, I was really unaware of what was happening in the industry, but it was having a huge impact on our food supply and on you know, the quality of our environment. So I became intrigued by the question as I started thinking about writing a book. I became intrigued by the question of, well, how did it get to this point? How did things become so industrialized in animal farming and yet at the same time Americans really understanding it?
Give us a quick thumbnail of how industrialized it has become.
Well, basically, pretty much all chickens raised for meat, all chickens raised for, and when I say all, I'm talking, you know, around 99%
right.
in these industries. So you have many wonderful smaller farmers doing something very, very different. But what I'm talking about is the big operations that are generally owned or controlled by agribusiness and are producing the vast majority of.
What do they look like for those of us
so
who...
So all the chickens, all the turkeys, all egg-laying hens, all dairy cattle, and all pigs are raised in metal buildings. They are kept continually confined for their entire lives in those buildings. In many cases, the buildings have no windows. They, in the case of pigs and dairy cattle and egg-laying hens, they're a metal or concrete floors that allow the manure to go through the floors because the floors are perforated or slatted, and then the manure is actually gathered up beneath the buildings and is then periodically pumped out or removed. Mm-hmm. And then stored in often very big open-air ponds of liquefied manure.
Hey, you know what? It sounds like people in cities.
and actually, it's a lot like people in really dense cities, except for there's this very big difference, and that is that the law has recognized the need for sanitation when you deal with human waste. And so we don't allow someone to develop an apartment building without having a plan for how all of the feces and urine that are going to be produced by those people are going to be dealt with. But with factory farms, the government has treated it as essentially, you know, a farm, even though they're operating with this new factory model. And so whereas a traditional farm would have had much fewer animals, far fewer animals, and would have had them outside on grass, and their manure would have been incorporated in the soil and actually benefited the soil and the plants that would grow there. And so there really wasn't a major pollution problem under that system. But when you put them into the buildings, you know, increase exponentially the population size of the animals, then all of a sudden you have these masses of manure that really do cause huge environmental problems for groundwater.
So what do they do with it? What do they do with all the manure?
Well, it sort of varies by species, you know, how it's stored. In some cases, as I was mentioning a moment ago, it's stored as a liquid. That's probably the biggest environmental problem is where it's stored as a liquid, because when you have these huge manure ponds or tanks even, they are continually leaking bacteria and other pollutants, nitrogen and so forth, to groundwater, and they're highly susceptible to massive spills. So we've seen examples every year. There are dozens of major spills, mm-hmm. in which literally hundreds of millions of gallons.
So a quick thumbnail of a factory of the modern factory farm animal farm is a lot of metal buildings with a lot of fecal matter coming out of them. And that's what we ended up with. So how did we get there? Did we have a choice?
Well, we certainly did. And I, you know, one of the main purposes I had in writing my book, Righteous Pork Chop, was to try to sort of unpack the history a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's this sort of constant refrain that we hear nowadays coming from agribusiness that the system we have now is really the only system we could have in order to produce enough food for America.
Well, yeah, that's the rub, you know. We all love our cheap hamburgers. The ultimate question is, can we have cheap hamburgers without factory farms?
And well, I think we can have reasonably priced hamburgers, put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the points that I argue is that probably the amount of money we're paying for meat and dairy products and eggs today is not appropriate. It doesn't reflect the actual cost of
production. You mean cheap food isn't?
Yes, I do mean cheap food is not. And, you know, I mean, you can get into looking at externalized costs, the cost of on society, of production.
Who pays to clean up the fecal matter?
Well, you know, when you have these major spills and you have leakage into groundwater, in many cases, either the general public, because environmental agencies get involved.
That would be me, right?
That would be each of us.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, it's just some poor, hapless individual. For example, in states like North Carolina, where they have extremely high number rates of these confinement hog operations and poultry operations, they have found that there's a very high percentage of contamination of neighboring well water. And so what's actually happening is you have individuals living on farms that their family has owned sometimes for generations, and they have only one source of water for drinking and washing and so forth. And that ends up being so contaminated by these neighboring operations, and I have met people in this exact circumstance, that they can no longer use their own water. And if the government doesn't take action, which unfortunately it rarely does,
because
people are left with literally no source of water to their property. So, you know, sometimes you have certain individuals that are paying a really high price for this kind of production method. And in general, I think, you know, all of us pay for it, because the other thing we haven't talked about yet, but it's a huge cost of these operations, is the overusage of drugs. There's so much use of drugs on these operations that...
In what respect? What do you mean?
Pardon me?
What do you mean overuse of drugs?
Well, when... one of the things I document in my book is that starting around 1950, and it first happened in the poultry industry, because poultry kind of pioneered all these
mm-hmm.
methods, we began adding, American production farmers began adding drugs to daily feed. And it was done because...
Like antibiotics?
Yes, often antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
And other kinds of drugs as well, but very often it was antibiotics.
So we have just a couple seconds left, but if I may, what we are saying is that we drug these animals through their feed to keep them healthy in an otherwise unhealthy situation.
Right, exactly, and to stimulate faster growth. It's
mm-hmm.
done for
so all of the costs of factory farm agriculture are not being borne by the farmer or by the consumer of those goods, but many of those costs are being borne by the taxpayer at large.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. When we come back, what Bill Nyman did to address this situation. Do stay tuned. Well, folks, some time ago they moved the animal farm into a great big factory so that you and I could have cheap food. But hey, how cheap is cheap food? Here, that's what we're talking about today with Bill Nyman, who is the founder of Nyman Ranch Meats, and also Nicolette Hahn Nyman, who is the author of Righteous Pork Chop, Finding a Life and a Good Food Beyond Factory Farms. Nicolette, we were talking a little bit about the true cost of cheap food, and is there really a way of really measuring that, what the true cost of food is?
Well, one of the things, I mean, we were starting to talk about this before the break. One of the things that we are seeing, obviously, from the shift in production methods is a dramatic increase in water pollution coming from livestock operations.
Right. And not only in terms of the fecal content or the animal waste, but the drugs that are in that waste, right?
Right. Well, so there are multiple negative consequences from this dependence on drugs. And as you suggested earlier, the reason the drug use increased so much was both because it brought down production costs, because it makes the animals grow a little bit faster, but also because these environments are so unhealthy. They're you know, very crowded. They're breathing dirty air continually because they're always confined. And there's just a tremendous disease transmission problem in these operations. And in order to control the disease, they're continually fed antibiotics. And so we have both the problem of a pollution from these operations that's more toxic because it contains residues from these medications, but also because it contains bacteria that have become resistant to these drugs. And it also causes the potential for consumers of the meat, not just people in proximity to the farms, they're probably at the greatest risk, but also anyone who's consuming meat from these operations, meat, dairy, or eggs from these operations, has a certain risk that they're exposing themselves to encountering drug-resistant bacteria in that food.
Which is something we've been dealing with throughout the food chain with respect to E. coli 015787, correct?
Yes.
Wow, Bill Nyman, when you first started Nyman Ranch Meats, were you cognizant of the extent to which industrial agriculture was taking over animal husbandry?
Well, we were actually quite fortunate to, in the beginning, we were not aware of what was going on in the industry. Although, as we asked questions and began our journey of discovery, reading trade journals, and which were certainly dominated by the drug companies and the manufacturers of other compounds to replace animal husbandry and increase growth of animals, we became more and more aware of it. And as a result of that, actually my partner at the time, Orville Schell, wrote a book called Modern Meat, which really was a, I think he was ahead of his time when he traveled around and visited farms and feedlots and confinement poultry and hog facilities that were actually, had bought into the whole drug company promotional materials and were using these enormous amounts of compounds. And in fact, he was one of the, you know, went down to Amarillo, Texas when the DES was being used, female, you know, estrogens, mm-hmm. which ended up unforeseen consequences of a lot of cervical cancer and young women whose mothers used that drug, and it was rampantly used in the livestock industry in the 60s and 70s, and he was one of the people that wrote about that. So we did become aware of it. Again, fortunately, our mentors in our part of the country had already considered the use or not use of those things and stayed the course with traditional livestock husbandry as we did. So for us, we would, I guess, what drove all of our decision-making was to really raise our animals in a natural way. And a natural way means allowing the animals to do what they are instinctively driven to do and creating an environment where they can actually realize those instinctive natural goals.
So tell us about the protocols for your farmers, because I guess what you do is with Nyman Ranch Meats was the demand for your meats became so. I mean, you had some of the most famous chefs in the world putting your name next to their menu items. You know, you want prime rib? Here was some Nyman Ranch prime rib. So the demand for your products grew incredibly, so you had to go out and find other farmers to do what you would want them to do. Explain your protocols.
Well, first of all, it happened actually rather slowly and methodically over time, so it was adding one customer and one additional farmer at a time. It wasn't
right.
about writing a business plan and going out and seducing or recruiting, rolling up like-minded people. It was really just adding one person at a time. And, you know, again, I was fortunate to be, I think, in the epicenter of what was happening in current cuisine, you know, the kind of being in the San Francisco Bay Area in the 70s and 80s with Alice Waters and Judy Rogers of Zuni and actually Margaret Fox from Café Beaujolais and Chris Kump, whose father started the James Beard Foundation, were my mentors in the back from the back of the house at the restaurant. So I learned as much about the meat business from them, telling me how they felt it should supposed to be, and I did everything I could to get it there, and was really, you know, I was so focused on eating quality because it had my name on it, and so we were supporting each other in that effort. But you know, I first started adding. To answer your question, I first networked with my neighbors who were very good at what they did, and we grew our business little by little. And then as the rate of growth picked up, I was fortunate to meet people like Larry Cleverly in Mingo, Iowa, and Paul Willis in Thornton, Iowa, and was able to discover what great pork really is. And they put together a network of farmers, one at a time, like-minded, mm-hmm. so we really didn't have to reform anybody. We just assembled all the like-minded people that were already raising their animals according to the protocols that we established. And basically that protocol was establishing an environment where the animals can thrive and not replacing good animal husbandry with man-made compounds, antimicrobials, antibiotics, sulfas, and so on, which were routinely being used. So
essentially you didn't put them in little tiny cages and feed them lots of drugs.
That's correct.
And let them be animals, right?
Exactly. And it's hard for people to understand sometimes that the farmers and ranchers that raise animals actually care for their animals and want to provide a really happy, wonderful environment where they can thrive. And anybody who raises hogs or poultry knows that those animals are not happy in the miserable conditions that industrial agriculture has created for them. So the Nyman Ranch farmers and my neighbors, people who mentored me, really appreciate the need to provide a lifestyle for livestock, even though they're going to be used for food, that they can thrive in and be happy in. And happy animals, wholesome animals, make better food.
And isn't that an interesting notion, to eat food from happy animals? Oh, my goodness. Rather than animals that have been locked up in tiny little jail cells and fed drugs. What do you want to eat, folks? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Bill Nyman, founder of Nyman Ranch Meats, Nicolette Hahn Nyman, rancher, lawyer, and author of Righteous Pork Chop, Finding a Life and Good Food Beyond Factory Farms. And so, Nicolette, do you like it out here on the West Coast?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Do you like it out here on the West Coast?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Okay, right back. Do stay tuned, folks. Well, folks, we all want good food, and we don't want to pay a lot of money for it. We want to go to the hamburger stand and get a hamburger and pay some pocket change, or a chicken sandwich and pay that pocket change. And so how on earth can we grow food so that we can have food at a reasonable cost? And yet, you know, we'd like to have some good food, too. We'd like to have some food that was raised happy. I'm thinking of a time when I visited Joel Salatin in the Shenandoah River Valley of Virginia, and he moves his cattle from one pasture to the next. You know, they kind of rotate them through so they have fresh grass once in a while. And I watched as he opened the gate and let the cattle go from one parcel of lot to the next. And I swear to God, the cattle had smiles on their face. And I got to thinking, you know, that's the kind of food I would like to eat, and I'd like to feed my family and happy animals and healthy animals. And I'm not sure I want to eat the foods that come from those big factories that are caged up in little tiny cages and fed a never-ending stream of drugs. But is it possible to have good food at reasonable prices? So that's the question we're asking today, and we're asking Bill Nyman, founder of Nyman Ranch Meats, and Nicolette Hahn Nyman, who is the author of Righteous Pork Chop. And Bill, let's start with you. Gosh, you built a huge business up, and it's gone. So I'm wondering, is it possible for us to have good food and still, you know, have a viable business model here? Oops.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer that it is possible. And
good.
I certainly learned a lot from my experience with Nyman Ranch, and that it's important to, if I could do it over again, I would do it differently. But I'm confident that there can be a sustainable economic model that would work, and I believe it's about keeping it regional, and not quite local, but regional and smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And what also has to happen is that people, and this is something that I've been advocating for, you know, my life now is really advocating for change, changing the way animals are treated, trying to create, you know, restore a more sensible way and common sense way of raising food. But one of the important things is for people to have, one, to eat smaller portions of meat, and you have maybe...
And thinking about that, I think that's a good one.
And it's very important to have maybe fewer meal occasions that have meat at the center of the plate. And
say that again.
Rather than have meat every day, have it on fewer occasions, maybe three times a week or five mm-hmm. times a week instead of seven. And so if everybody cut their meat consumption in half, then there would be half as many animals on the landscape, and I believe everybody would be better off for that. Additionally, you know, it's there are a lot of enterprises out there that are really fostering change. For example, Chipotle Mexican Grill, who probably the largest purchaser of natural-based foods in the country, and they offer, you know, a really positive and affordable choice to other quick service and casual restaurant diners. So it's not easy, and you can't make these choices in every region today, but I think more and more as people become aware of the real cost of their food and remember these traditional farmers that make up the Niman Ranch enterprise and other farm groups like them are not externalizing their costs. So what you pay for meat from a Niman Ranch farmer or other like-minded
is the real cost.
Absolutely. And the same thing when Chipotle purchases those products, they're paying the real cost as well and not being subsidized by tax dollars or public health dollars when people get sick from, well, look what's happening with this MRSA, MRSA infection in Camden, Indiana.
What's this now?
Well, the Christoph piece, there's this incredibly resilient strain of infections called
MRSA.
Right. And 18,000 people a year die from this. So it dwarfs mad cow disease, AIDS, and so on, and death in this country each year. And this is a result of antibiotic-resistant pathogens that many people believe are coming from the misuse of antibiotics in livestock feed.
And that is the true cost of that meat.
That's the true cost. Now, if you could calculate the billions that are being spent treating this kind of infection and other infections that really kind of come from these resistant pathogens, then you get to the real cost. And these numbers have been quantified, and they're in the billions.
Nicolette, same question to you. Is there a viable alternative to industrial animal husbandry?
Yes. Like Bill, we're both very optimistic that there's a much better system possible and that there are lots of signs for hope that we're actually beginning to move that way because there's the pendulum is beginning to swing back. Consumers are starting to understand that the food is not wholesome that they're getting out of factory farms. And that there are so many costs and it's a system they don't really want to participate in.
Nicolette, how do you overcome the government? I mean, you know, these people can get away with murder almost simply by paying off, by donating generously to campaign funds.
Yeah, well, that has been the huge barrier to change, has been the amount of money from agribusiness in the political system. So as each of these problems started emerging in the public consciousness, whether it was the pollution or the antibiotic resistance issue or the cruel treatment of the animals, there was always this huge amount of money being spent in, sort of defense.
So is there a way to overcome that money?
Well, I think there are several answers. First of all, I just came back from Washington, D.C., literally last night.
Okay, you're going to have to... Can you hold those answers?
Sure.
Okay, we're
going to
take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll finish up with that. And one final question for the both of you. What can we as consumers do to bring real food back to our tables? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back. Well, we all want good food at a reasonable price, but hard to find. Think about it. The real price of food is often hidden and foisted off to you and I, the taxpayer. It's made possible because there are very powerful people who give a lot of money to elected authorities so that they have their way in the world. And we're talking a little bit about how that can possibly be overcome with Bill and Nicolette Niman. Nicolette, we were talking a little bit about what you could possibly do to overcome money in Washington. I don't know. What would that be?
Well, what I was starting to say before the break is I just returned from Washington, D.C., and I have to say I've never felt so much optimism there for change, not just in a general way, but specifically in agriculture and food production methods because of, the new administration and an openness that really seems to be there to these ideas that we need to consider health care costs and health consequences for communities in our food production. And we can't just look at agriculture and think about, trying to maximize production as the only goal, which has been what we've really been, doing for the last several decades. So I would say I do think there is some opportunity. We'll see how it shakes out. But
you don't think they'll take any money in Washington now?
Yeah, the money's there. It's not going to change. But I do think you have leadership at the top of certainly, President
Governor Vilsack?
Pardon me?
The Secretary of Agriculture?
Yeah, you know, I don't know him personally. We a lot of our friends do because, of course, he's from Iowa and was the governor there and was, you know, at Drake University in Iowa. So many of our friends in Iowa know him quite well.
Good.
I think there's a hopefulness that he will be an improvement over past Secretaries of Agriculture. I don't think he's going to be advocating for any radical change.
Okay. But, well, let me ask both of you the big question. I don't think that any change at all will ever come from the government. That's just the skeptical Montana boy in me. But I think the real change is going to come from you and I. And so what can we do as consumers to change our world?
Yeah, I do think it's both. I think that we always have to be looking for, you know, improvements in enforcement. You know, a lot of what we were doing when I was at Waterkeeper Alliance was just trying to get existing laws enforced. And those are the kinds of things that the government can do. But I also think that every individual in this country can begin thinking about their own food purchasing, because every dollar we put into the food system is supporting one model or another. And if we all begin, as Bill was talking earlier, about sort of thinking about reducing our total meat and dairy consumption in order to, you know, try to spend the same amount of money and get better quality.
Less is more.
Yeah, exactly. And we always say, you know what? Eat less meat, eat better meat.
Okay, less is more. Right. Eat less, but eat better.
Yes.
Bill, are you there, Bill?
Yes, I am.
What should we do? What should I do as a consumer?
Well, I think, first of all, you need to ask the question whenever you're purchasing something, where does this stuff come from and how is it raised?
That I do. Drive everybody nuts.
Yeah, and I think looking into community-supported agriculture, CSAs, support your farmer's market, put a face on your food, meet the person who's actually raised that food, okay?
Food with the farmer's face on it.
Right, and I guess probably the most important thing, you should purchase Nicolette's book and read about it. Then you'll learn what you can do.
A good husband with a perfect pitch. Bill and Nicolette Nyman, thank you both so much for joining us today. And thank you all out there for tuning in the Food Chain. Watch you to all stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on the Food Chain. And hey, remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.